Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. My guest today is Nathan Gelgud. If I said that name correctly, I just asked. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you got it.
All right. And we're here to talk about, I would say, realpolitik. Maybe it's realpolitik.
I always just say politik. Yeah.
Realpolitik, not realpolitik, which right. is a comic strip and newly a book about the intersection of revolutionary politics and the movies. And as a fan of both radical politics and the movies, I read about this book in Sight and Sound and just immediately wanted more and invited Nathan on the show. So Nathan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. What, you read about it in Sight and Sound?
Yeah, I did.
I don't know about this.
You weren't aware that you were in Sight and Sound?
No, not at all.
What?
We could cover it. We could cover it later. But yeah, let me know where that was. I didn't hear about that or see that.
I think I know where my most recent copy of Sight and Sound is. Real quick, let me run and try and get it. Sorry, we can edit
sure.
it out or not. Hopefully, this will be like 20 seconds.
Okay.
Hello, dear listener. This is Graham. While Nathan sat there patiently, I failed to find the issue of Sight and Sound, but I can tell you now that Realpolitik was featured in the October 2025 issue of Sight and Sound. Now back to me telling Nathan that I didn't find it at the time. I have too many copies of Sight and Sound.
Okay.
Lying around.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So
you know what's funny? What's funny about that? I'm sure we'll track it down later. But along, like over 10 years ago, the cartoonist Sammy Harkham was giving me advice about, because I make these shirts and bags, like these movie themed shirts and bags. But the comics making I was doing was kind of, the subject matter was disparate. I mean, it was everywhere. And Sammy was like, you should make comics about movies, because everyone who wants to shirts and bags will want to read comics about movies, and everybody who, you know, and vice versa. And I even think the kind of idea that we threw around was like, we should try to get me like a page in Sight and Sound where every month there's like a little comic about, you know, about movies by me in Sight and Sound. That was just like the example that we threw around. So this is funny. I can't wait to see what they printed, because that was Realpolitik, and it's sort of like, it took me 10 years to take his advice basically, but like eventually that's what I did. I just started making comics about movies almost exclusively.
Yeah. And, I'm so embarrassed that I brought this up and then couldn't track down the reference.
I'm glad you brought it up, because I didn't know. I was actually, before we got on the line, I was thinking of asking you, because I didn't know how you found out about it. And, you know, Drawn and Quarterly is an amazing publisher, but outside the world of comics, they're not super known. And like, I've been using Instagram to post the comics, but my following is pretty modest, so I'm always excited when someone knows about it, and I don't know how they knew about it, you know.
Yeah. So I was gonna ask you how you got this idea to, you know, be making comics about movies. So it sounds like we've kind of covered both of those two things along the way by accident. Yeah, it was in Sight and Sound. There was a nice little write up. It wasn't like a long article. We'll find it. We'll find it. And I don't know how much of this is going to be edited. I mean, certainly the part where I walk away and look for Sight and Sound, I'm going to edit that out.
Do you read a lot of film magazines? I mean, there's only a few left, but
the only one I read is Sight and Sound. I mean,
that used to be such a big part of my life, was like just all the, you know, especially when I lived in New York, going to like St. Mark's Books and getting the new Cine Action, or the, you know, or at least, you know, like at the time, actually, I would just kind of hunch over them in the bookstore, because they were like, those magazines were like, I mean, now magazines are like $20, but even back then, I feel like they were like They were like $8 or $9, you know?
Nothing. I know. My kids will, like, in the grocery store, they'll be like, you know, like a special edition of something about like Pokemon or Batman. I'm like, yeah,
like a Bluey magazine or something.
Yeah, and it's 1999.
And my kids like, yeah. And my kids like, I want that. And like, I've learned now, but like as of 2 years ago, like my impulse was like, yeah, sure, a magazine. Why not?
Sure, grab a magazine. Yeah, what could it be?
It was like $20.
Yeah, $3.99. It can't be more than that, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I used to read those film magazines in undergrad, and I read them in the library. And I went to a university called the University of South Carolina, which is frequently confused with the University of Southern California just because of initials.
Well, not by me, because I went to North Carolina State University.
So oh, we were really? I did not know that. So, I mean, I teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill right now. So that means we're hated rivals. Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We're doing this all backwards. This is hilarious. This is the most.
No, I used to hang out. I was in Chapel Hill constantly. I mean, I liked Raleigh and I lived there even after school. But, you know, Chapel Hill was a little cooler, you know? So like.
Yeah. Did you ever go to the Chelsea Theater?
Yeah. All the time. I saw Pola X there. I saw, that's a big one that I remember. Like driving there to go see it, because I had actually visited New York a month previous and seen it, and I came, whatever. I would go to the Chelsea all the time. I mean, in a way, like Real Politic is like, you know, that's the kind of theater that they work in. It's like,
yeah,
their theater is a single screen theater, just because like I just love the romance of that, and it's more manageable to like manage the narrative when they're only showing one thing at a time, of course. But like, theaters like the Chelsea, or what was the one on, was it called the Varsity? What was the one on the main drag on Franklin?
The Varsity still exists. The Chelsea does too. The Varsity still exists, but it's no longer like an art house theater. Okay. Although they sometimes screen the UNC film program sometimes screens films there a lot of times for free. So I used to work at the Chelsea. So I don't know, depending on what years you were there.
That's so funny. Yeah. That would have been like late 90s.
Yeah. So I started at the Chelsea in 2005. So,
okay.
So we missed each other, but man,
there was a theater in Raleigh on Hillsborough Street called Studio 1 and 2, which was a lot like the Chelsea in terms of like the programming. It was the same thing. It was, you know, it was like, you know, smaller movies, you know, occasionally lucky enough to get something, you know, excellent from, well, whatever. But yeah, it was like on Hillsborough Street, and you'd walk down, there was a marquee out front, but then you'd walk down a hall, and on the left was like a bar, and on the right, which I don't think I ever went in once, but then on the right was our little movie theater. And I worked there for about a year.
Yeah, and the Chelsea, of course, I'm going to give you a second to introduce the book, and we can have a conversation that the listeners actually want to hear. But, I mean, first of all, it's thing.
It's relevant.
Right? This is a movie going, for some of us, is just a crucial part of our life. It's a community. It lets you connect with people, you know.
How have you done with that since having kids?
Oh, terribly, terribly. Yeah. I mean, My kids are 9 and 6, and you know, we just don't go to the movies that often anymore. We went and saw in Raleigh. We had to go to Raleigh In the Mood for Love, the recent 25th anniversary screening, and we got a babysitter, and you know, but that's like a once every 6 months thing.
Yeah, you can't do it. I mean, you got to find stuff when there's stuff that's during the day while they're in school. That's like the dream.
Yeah. Well, we just took our kids to see Son of Frankenstein, which the third, which I'd never seen, the third Frankenstein movie, and they loved it. I mean, they were the only kids there, but whatever, they loved it.
Yeah,
so that's
the
thing.
And that went okay.
I took them
to see, we have this place out here. I live in Los Angeles now, but we have this place out here called Vidiot's, which is really great. And they showed this movie called Flying Down to Rio, which was I don't remember the director's name because I didn't really know him. But Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers are in it, but they're not the leads. They're like the buddies, the comic relief buddies, which was really fun to see. And they showed it on film, which was great, at like in like the middle of the day on a Saturday. And I took – we have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old. An 8-year-old does great, but I'm always nervous about the 4-year-old, especially if it's just me, because if he can't stay, like she can't just sit in there by herself. Yeah. So anyway, but they loved it. He sat there and watched the whole thing. He was super into it. And I also really recommend that movie. It was terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know that one. My wife and I
didn't either. I didn't know anything. Yeah.
We're currently in the middle of one called Roberta. You know, we watch a movie after the kids go to bed and then we fall asleep before we finish the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which it's kind of Fred Astaire, Randolph Scott co-lead. Uh-huh. And then Ginger Rogers and Irene Dunne are there. But I'm a bigger Randolph Scott fan than I am a Fred Astaire fan. I love the Baedeker westerns. Let me say briefly, I just wanted to say the Chelsea is great now because they do this whole repertory thing. It's wonderful, but it also is now it's now a nonprofit. Like that's what it has to do. The guy who used to run it, Bruce Stone. He was an old English teacher. He was a creative writing teacher in Chapel Hill. And he, you know, just made a go of it and made an independent cinema work in Chapel Hill for decades. But then eventually the cinema is, I always compare it to like the opera now. Like it's a thing for that rich people pay for so that intellectuals can enjoy. And that's not what it was.
Oh, I see what you mean.
We're growing up, and it's not what we want it to be. And the like thriving vibrancy of the cinema, it seems to me, is sort of on the downslope. And the fact that Chelsea exists and shows great movies is great, but the fact that it has to be, you know, at the beginning, it's like thanks to all of our donors, and you know, it's local businesses, but also just like local rich people, and like we're kind of depending on this. So I would love to like seize the Chelsea in the guerrilla style, but that's just not. So now finally tell us what Realpolitik is.
Oh, sure. So Realpolitik is a comic strip about a group of movie theater workers who radicalize and take over their movie theater in an attempt to launch a Marxist Leninist revolution via film programming. And there's magical elements and even some science fictional elements. And it's an ongoing comic strip. And this book that comes out in November is the first collection released by Drawn and Quarterly, which collects the first, I think, like 4 or 5 months of strips.
Yeah. And I'll just say now, I mean, I read it. I loved it. It blends a gag comic and a narrative. So it's both. I mean, and I think it does a good job of being both.
Thank you. The primary effort or fun thing for me about it was to do a daily strip and just to pretend that I had an editor demanding a strip every day. And because just as an exercise, you know, like as an artistic exercise, it was great. I mean, it was too much to keep. I did it for 1 year, and at 365, I was like, I can't keep doing this every single day because it's not. There's just not paying me anything. It's not. it takes over your life because all day you're thinking, what's my joke? You know, like what's the joke? What's the idea? So, like the rules I kind of made up for myself was that basically it just has to have a gag every day, and it doesn't have to, you know, or something that we're like, it has the structure of a joke, even if I didn't figure out how to like land the joke every day, there's like, you understand that there's an effort to tell a joke, and to use these characters and to stick, you know, semi closely to the subject of movies every day. And then sort of, I'm saying this because you brought up the sort of balancing act between it being a daily gag strip and being a sort of a continuing narrative. I think that just happens with me. Like I just, I can't help but start. So like inside the book, there are little mini stories kind of that, you know, they resolve or they don't, or you can kind of see a pattern of like, oh, he just, you know, there'll be like 5 or 6 days or even longer of like one little mini story. And then all of a sudden it just kind of goes back to a one-off strip where it's just like, it's just a self-contained strip that has nothing necessarily to do with what came before or what's coming tomorrow. Reading like old collections of like, you know, Peanuts or Nancy or something like that, it's like surprising that how rare it is that they, I mean, they really stuck to like just a gag every day for decades, which is like, it's not good or bad. It's just, I can't resist that pull of like, I want to try to keep telling, you know, like that thing that I, that idea that I introduced yesterday, let me just continue that idea or that little thought or that story. And then sometimes it would like, I just did it for like 3 days, and then sometimes I'll do it for like a month.
Yeah.
But you felt like it worked. You felt like,
Yeah, I did. I mean, I felt like, there are definitely, definitely I noticed times that the little story that you're following just stops, you know, like, right. And that makes sense. I didn't realize that you were literally doing it every day for a year. And again, that just seems like, that just works perfectly in terms of inhabiting this way that comics used to be made. I mean, I also remember reading Peanut, like so many Peanuts collections as a kid, and there were like recurring tropes, probably the, you know, the football is the most famous one, or
yeah.
The therapist is in, but there's no stories really like over the course of a
there's
week.
I mean, there's times where like the strip is doing the same, like it's the same two characters continuing, sort of continuing a conversation. But yeah, I just can't, it's just surprising to me that the pull of like having it build, they were just able to resist that or just felt that it wouldn't fit into a newspaper strip. Where like yesterday's strip is in the garbage. Like you can't, and then, like if you didn't read it yesterday, it's gone forever, you know?
Yeah, I guess now that you mentioned that, that is the explanation given for why TV started telling longer stories was once you had DVDs and DVRs, you could say, oh, if you missed episode one, but you need to watch episode one to watch episode two, that's okay. You can buy all of season one.
Yeah. I worked in a video store when that first started happening. Like when Sopranos was released, it made me so furious. I was so upset. Because it was people coming into the video store and renting TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, it bothered me so much.
Yeah, I definitely jumped on board with the, like, someone, maybe it was A.O. Scott in the Times, you know, they call them like mega movies. And I was like, yeah, like in like 2008, if you'd asked me, like is long form TV shows good? I would have been like, yes, they're awesome. And I just started watching this show called Mad Men and it's so good. And I still love Mad Men. I still love The Wire, but mostly it seems that my heart has always been and has returned to the cinema with an especial emphasis on going to the movie theater, despite the fact that doesn't happen as much these days. I mean, a lot of the things that popped up as I was reading this that I was thinking about talking to you about, I actually just did an interview with Paul Schrader where I talked about a number of these things. Like I was really struck by this idea, this like Brechtian idea of, talking during the performance, of interrupting, of interrupting the movies, because I'm intrigued. Maybe I've always been intrigued by this sort of problem of like the movie as a sacred place, the place where you have to be quiet, and also like the movie where you're supposed to be yelling at the screen. And right now, it seems like people have decided there's some kinds of movies where you can yell at the screen, and some kinds of movies where you're not allowed to yell at the screen. But
what was this? What was the connection with the Schrader conversation? I'm curious.
Oh, well, just because Paul, he describes in Transcendental Style in film, and he talks about in the introduction of that, of like of going to the movies, like going to a church, is a form of like consent. You're agreeing to be there, mm-hmm. and you can leave if you want. So it's voluntary in that sense, but you can't disrupt it. If you disrupt it, you're, you know, not doing the thing anymore of, mm-hmm. Of taking part in the worship or taking part in watching the movie. And mm-hmm. I want something a little more, I want the potential to be more disruptive in the, mm-hmm. in the movie theaters. At least, you know, one of my least favorite movies of all time, which you take a shot at in the book, is American Beauty. And mm-hmm. I just like would have loved to, I didn't see American Beauty in the theaters. I watched it later after it won the Academy Award, because it won the Academy Award. But mm-hmm. I would have loved to have been in a theater.
You hadn't, learned your, you hadn't learned your lesson yet about.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, by,
not
by
bothering. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Look, I don't bother. I was young, you know, I think yeah, I was no, in I college.
I get it. So the strips you're talking, there are some strips in there where the characters are kind of talking about, they're reading Brecht, who is one of their, you know, idols. And they're reading about how Brecht just said that the theater should be like a boxing match where, and he's talking about the theater. He's talking about the actual, you know, he's not yeah. talking about movie theaters, where the spectator is like a sports fan, and he can shout at the performers. When he sees something he likes or doesn't like or whatever. And so they, as like these, what you, I hate this word, but what you call cinephiles, are people who have kind of grown up in this idea that, like you're talking about, where the movie theater is a church and you're quiet and you're it's, you, worship at the altar of the screen, and they suddenly switch their thinking because they're revolutionaries who embrace a Brechtian theory of art, and so they start encouraging their art. They start telling their audience that it's okay to yell at the screen, it's okay to talk to the screen, it's okay to talk in the theater. To me, it was important. A couple of things about that. To me, it was important that they also emphasized the idea that what they were really doing was discouraging people from being upset with their audience, fellow audience members, mm. when their fellow audience members were talking or making noise, because they said, we're all comrades. We're all here together and we're all comrades. And I remember the feeling of being someone who went to, you know, at least a movie a day, sometimes two or three in New York in my 20s, of that tension that I felt all the time of someone's going to make noise, someone's going to talk. And yeah. it stressed me out so much. And I'm going to have to say something about it. And what am I going to do? And I was thinking about that. And then the other thing I liked about doing that was that I like that they have this philosophy. They've taken over this theater. They're literally, if sort of, ridiculously trying to start a revolution from the movie theater. But then they read one little piece of theory and they're like, okay, that part of our theory is different now. We have a new approach now. Because I was reading a lot about, I mean, anybody, but I was reading about like May 68 or watching like Godard's La Chinoise, and you realize, or like reading about the Weather Underground, and you realize these guys were like 22. You know what I mean? Like, and they were ready to like go kill people in the name of like something that they just read, or, you know what I mean? Like that, I'm being a little, I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but there's something funny about it. There's also just something that's exciting about it. And there's also something that's like dangerous about it. About this idea of like the fact that revolution belongs to the youth to whom these ideas are like relatively new. So that's just a long kind of response to your interest in those strips in the book. I also was like really interested in Brechtian theory. I still am, but like, I got, when I was at North Carolina State, I studied with this professor named Joe Gomez, to whom this first collection is dedicated. And he was someone who was interested in Brecht. It wasn't like his guy, but he saw in me, this is going to be your guy, mm-hmm. which is just like, that's a gift that a teacher, I mean, you teach now, so like you understand what I'm talking about. Like, that's the kind of gift that a teacher can give a student, is not necessarily just here's what I know, but I see what you're interested in, and you're going to respond to this. So he gave me Brecht on theater. He told me to watch If and Oh Lucky Man. And then of course that's the Brecht stuff gave me a grip on what Godard was doing throughout his career, really, from the very beginning. I never really read Brecht's actual theater. I've never sat down with the plays at all. Yeah. I just love the essays.
Yeah, I'm afraid me as well. I mean, I've read a few of them. I find the Galileo really interesting, but yeah, no, I also know Brecht as a theorist.
It's not out of it like lack of interest. It's just you get these weird blind spots, you know, where you're just like, why did I never? I mean, I guess it's rare that I sit down with a play.
So that's the thing. Theater is, you know, I'd rather see it perform, but they're not doing Brecht that much these days. At least in Chapel Hill, there's not a lot of Brecht out there. I mean, look, I absolutely reading this book got that sense that these are the sort of like naive, underprepared Marxist, Leninist revolutionaries. You know, Dwight MacDonald was pretty famously scathing about what he called the new left, these kids in the 60s, a lot for that reason. Like, they were like, all right, there's 12 of us, and we've taken over our college campus, and we're going to have a revolution. And Dwight MacDonald was like, do you know what a revolution is or how you achieve one? And they're like, well, we read 3 pages of Mao, so we're going to do it now.
Yeah, but I also think it's a misplaced criticism, you know? I think that it's like, I haven't read the MacDonald stuff that you're talking about, but I'm completely aware of that, you know, tendency of an older kind of often like, you know, lib who's saying you don't know what you're talking about, instead of I understand what you're feeling, you know, and I understand why you're upset. And oftentimes I think that notion of you don't know what a revolution is, which is probably true, but it's really just a way of saying, shut up. And it's really just a way of saying, your concerns are not valid. And it's really just a way of saying, we have a system and you need to play inside of it. And if you don't, then it's because you don't know what you're talking about. It's because you're naive. It's because you haven't had enough experience. And those of us who are experienced know that you must play within the confines of this system, which is a perfectly fine system. And so they're not really they're not really having the same conversation, because they're not meeting the youthful radical movement on its foundational notion, which is that we don't have a system within which we can play, we can discuss things. We're outside of that discussion, which is another thing that playfully, I hope, and humorously, I hope, the book is about, which is that they don't have a Weather Underground to join. They don't have, you know, Parisian Maoists to align with. They just feel like they have themselves. And I've kind of lost my thread a little bit here, but I'm just kind of responding to what you're saying about how I hope that in this book, because it's the way that these are the things that I'm thinking about, that's the tension. Is that there's some kind of humorous tension in there's the sincerity of these characters and their naivete, which, I mean, those two things go together, I think. Yeah. I mean, you have to be a little bit naive to be completely sincere, especially now. And it's funny because, like, I'm so much older than them. I'm kind of out of my depth. I mean, like, I don't know their peers, you know? But it seems to me from far outside that the way that we grew up, where there was such a thing as selling out, that doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't.
And I could be wrong, or that could be replaced by some other notion. And the idea of criticizing somebody for selling out in the 90s was problematic. And it led to probably a lot of people not pursuing their ambitions to the extent that they could have. But there was value in this idea that you were making stuff to make stuff for your friends or for yourself or to reach people who were like-minded, who felt like they didn't have anybody out there feeling and saying the things that they felt and wanted to say. And so, I don't know, like a couple of years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine about Barbie, the Barbie movie, right? And like, Gerwig's not a director who I was like super excited about, but she was making, you know, she was making real movies. Even like the Little Women movie is like, that's a movie as I understand what a movie to be, you know? Lady Bird was, you know, had its moments or whatever, but they were real movies. But anyway, I was trying to unpack this with a friend about Barbie and he's like, yeah, it's called selling out, dude. Like you're complicating this a little bit. Like that's what she did. And it was so celebrated. And it was the idea that like this person who I thought kind of represented something that was closer to what I grew up with when I was in my 20s, which was that like you make art and then you get to a certain position where you're able to make art without it being like an enormous struggle. So you make your little stuff with your friends and then you get to a point where you can make like a movie like Lady Bird where there's like, you know, there's like professional actors in it and et cetera, et cetera. Not that that should be, you can make, you know, movies that are all amateur are probably better anyway. But my point is that was like the level, you know what I mean? Like you were getting to the level of like, I don't know, like a band like Yola Tango, you know, was like enormous. Like that was huge, you know? And now I could be wrong. This might not be specific to now, but like, I feel like now it's like, no, you have to go, now you have to go make Barbie or she's making like Chronicles of Narnia now, you know? And like the option to just continue to make things at this level, even if offered the opportunity to do bigger, like it just seems to be gone. It's probably not. I every time I say something like that, I'm like, I'm wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong. And someone, you know what I mean?
No, I mean, look.
It's just a feeling. It's not really, I'm not saying that there's not like this is not an evidence-based take. I'm just kind of talking about
the
feelings I have. I'm not sure how we got here exactly.
As far as I'm concerned, this is good. We're talking about the intersection between movies and politics. Look, first, I mean, I have lots of things to say, and they're all that I agree with you. So first of all, I agree with you that the whole selling out thing is that seems to be dead. I mean, this is the daily struggle for me that people have heard on this podcast way too often. It's just like the students are professional creatures. They're in college for a degree. They're not here to learn. And that seems to me something.
Oh, that's it. That's how we got there. That's how we got there. Was that I was talking about how I'm out of my depth in this book, essentially because I don't know 20 somethings, and these characters are in their 20s. And
I don't think these characters are a good representation of 20 somethings in 2025.
Yeah, so my sense is that these guys, I mean, this is an absurdist, ridiculous comic strip, so I'm allowed to do whatever I want. But like, my sense is that these guys, that something like Barbie would be very alienating to, but not just the movie, but to see the way it was like almost unanimously celebrated. And you weren't even allowed to say like, this is idiotic. I didn't see it, but the idea of it offends me.
Oh, well, and, I can tell you it's awful. It's horrible. It's horrible. I did see it. And I guess I have now outed myself. I don't believe I've publicly told anyone that Barbie is a terrible movie. And I'm not sure I'm allowed to say this, but
I think you're safe now. But no, you know what I mean? Did you have that feeling too? Like you weren't allowed. It was like not allowed.
It wasn't so anyway, it was somehow working within the system to criticize the system. Right. But maybe that's a thing that you can do. But the Barbie movie wasn't it.
But yeah. So when you said maybe that's a thing you can do, I mean, these characters would reject that idea completely out of hand. Like the idea that you work within the system is just like a joke, you know, like it's just ridiculous. And So, all right. So we were talking about the idea of revolutionaries as naive fools. And, but when I think about like where these guys are probably at, like they're completely alienated. Like they feel like there's no place for them to have these ideas. There's no outlet for them to have ideas about radical politics. There's no, even somebody who does play within the confines, like Bernie Sanders, ends up, you know, you're a Bernie bro or whatever that stuff was, you know, like any, or you're completely ridiculous if you stick to the ideas of the ideas that he was talking about. Like once he lost the nomination, especially the first time, like once he lost the nomination, you weren't even allowed to like keep talking about it. Like, okay, we've moved on. We're all centrist lips now because we, you know what I mean? Cause I'm with her, you know? And this is just a way of kind of thinking about where these guys are at in this book. And so I think that that might be all right. So that's a way of like addressing this like common accusation that youthful revolutionaries are these dummies or that their ideas are all ill-conceived or half-baked. It's like, well, they have no context within which to develop these ideas in any kind of rational way. They're just on their own. They just have their books and their movies and each other. And so I guess I hadn't really thought about it as literally as that, but I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to work through in this book because I really sympathize with them. And I feel like that what they're trying to do is meaningful.
Yeah. And I want to say, one thing that's really important to me and is really important in this book, and I don't know that there's any wider embrace of this across the left, but there is in the, we're just going to use the word cinephile. I'm sorry. It's a dumb word. I agree. But like, I can't remember telling, I said the first time I said to someone, yeah, well, I'm a cinephile. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah, don't say that, Graham. Whatever you do, never say that phrase again. Yeah. But the idea that there is something valuable, meaningful, communal about the big screen and the small, I mean, here's another parenting example. You know, you hear parents talk a lot about screen time. That's a new thing. Is like how much screen time do your kids get? And you know, it's hard to remind people. You got to remind people that a screen is a blank thing. It blocks something. In a movie theater, it's a blank wall or canvas that blocks a beam of light such that light appears in front of everyone. A screen on your phone, it doesn't work that way. It's not a blocking screen. It seems to me that if you were saying to someone, they were like, how much screen time did your kids have yesterday? And you said, oh, well, 2 hours of screen time because I took them to Son of Frankenstein at the Carolina Theater. This claim wouldn't make any sense. This idea that these screens are vampiric, they're sucking our blood for capitalism, I think is accurate. And what you need is a place where your blood is not being sucked for capitalism. And, you know, the Thoreau thing of hiking in the woods, I'm a big fan of hiking in the woods. That's one way to do it. But going to the movie theater is another. It's almost, I wouldn't call it a revolutionary act, but it's a radical act almost, as opposed to TikTok. And when I try this out with my students, they're just like, you know, old man yells at cloud. They're like, I can watch movies on my phone and TikTok is so much fun and we all need a chance to relax. That's why I use the example of opera, because if someone had told me in like 1997 that opera was an important art form and it was radical to go to it, I would have just been like, shut up, old person. And I guess I am that person, but I'm still holding on to this belief that the cinema is radical in the age of TikTok and Instagram. And I found that in this book and it gave me some hope.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Yeah. And there's also, I think it's in this collection, but there's also stuff about how the sort of current iteration of the art house movie theater, which is, you know, like your Alamo Draft House, which I'm not knocking, but well, I guess I am, but like it's doing a lot to remove what you are describing as this, as the, I'm not sure I would use that use your language, but the revolutionary aspects of going to a movie.
I'm going with radical. I think it is radical. Yeah, yeah. And in a world of TikTok, I think going to the movies is a radical act.
Right. But they're sort of giving you a lot of the trap. It's almost like saying, okay, well, if you're going to look at this screen where you can't swipe, we need to give you something else where you're doing something. So like you can order a beer, you can get a hamburger, you can scan this. You're probably scanning a QR code at some point. You know what I mean? Like you can recline your seat. Not only can you recline it, you can put the footrest up. There's buttons. You can press these buttons. You know, like there's all these, there has to be trappings. And one of the things that was, I think, you know, the most, you know, the movie theater I like the best is where you just, all you can do is just kind of go in and sit there. And you should be a little bit uncomfortable. You know, the seats should be old and creaky. And because you're not there to lounge, you know.
Yeah, this is the quiet radicalism of going to the movies. And this is, this is an overused talking point, but like Scorsese, you know, like the theme park metaphor, I think is, I think is right. And I say that as someone who hates theme parks, for whom theme parks are like, as far as I can tell, TikTok and a roller coaster are basically the same experience, or channeling the same sort of rapid swerves and overwhelming sensations to the point that your consciousness is obliterated. And something like the Barbie movie, which I know you haven't seen, but it really does, like, it isn't a coherent story. I have no idea what the Barbie movie was about. It was closer to a series of sketches than a movie. And it was really important to that movie, that 2-hour viewing experience, that you be always stimulated by the next thing in a way that is, to me, really dispiriting. I will admit I didn't see Oppenheimer, so I can't compare.
I refuse to see that as well.
Yeah.
I won't get on my high horse about two movies that I didn't see, but,
I can't say anything about Oppenheimer. I mean, or besides that, I didn't see it. I would have probably if I hadn't had kids.
Yeah. There's a movie theater here called the Vista, which is a single screen theater, that closed during COVID. And, it was a great theater. And then during COVID, Tarantino bought it, and, very admirably did almost nothing except just make it a little bit better. Like, it's an old theater. It's just, I think he replaced the seats, but with just like normal movie theater seats and just spaced them. All he did was just space them out. Like, you can put your knees aren't up against the feet in front of you, but it's like a normal concession stand. And it's just this great theater with a big screen, and it's great. I love that he did that. And of course he owns the New Beverly as well, which is a terrific place. So it can be done, you know. I mean, they're showing one battle after another, and they're selling out 10 a.m. Wednesday screenings, you know. Like, I don't know. You don't need all that stuff. I mean, maybe you do. I don't know. Who cares? Like,
well, I mean, I guess the thing I would say in terms of it can be done, in terms of like the real world, as opposed to the absurd, delightful fantasy of realpolitik, is whether it's the Vista or the Chelsea, it's become a patronage model. And if you watch any like, European art theater or art movie now, in the opening credits, they'll have 20 like high-minded NGOs where they got the money from, like, you know, the Belgian Film Society, but then also the French Film Society, and then also some other foundation, like the movies. And, you know, this is where it's tricky, because, I mean, I guess what I'm advocating for is something that, you know, sounds like capitalism.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I'm not sure what ideas to engage with there, because it's kind of like, well, it's kind of, we all do it, but it's falling into a certain kind of trap, which is to say, like, there's a good and a bad way to do capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, like Boots Riley, you know, Boots Riley.
Yeah.
The filmmaker and musician. He talks about when he made his first, that his TV series, like that limited series for Amazon, you know, and he's a, you know, he's a communist revolutionary, and people were, I didn't see anybody like really giving him heavy flack for it, but his response to the idea of why someone like him would make something for Amazon, he said, like, look, that's kind of a con pulled on you to say that, like, within this system, there's good companies and bad companies. So, like, I'll go make something for the company that's not as bad as the other company, you know? But that's all just like, that's just a way of getting you to say, like, that by virtue of being able to choose between companies in a capitalist system, you have some agency, and it's maybe it's not that bad. You know, it's like the recycling ruse kind of, you know?
Well, what I'm objecting to is the George Sorosification of cinema, of like, you know, it's okay. It's outside of capitalism because there's a rich person who's going to take money that they made in capitalism, and they're going to launder that money. And one way they can launder that money is to fund the opera. And another way they can launder that money is libraries. And another way they can launder that money these days is the cinema. And so I'm not nostalgic for the age of Warner Brothers and MGM in the 30s and 40s, although I prefer them probably to the...
Well, I mean, I can't remember where it was, but somebody was talking about how those guys were capitalist pigs, but they got into the movie business because they wanted to make movies.
Yeah, that is
different. Maybe they wanted to make movies that were garbage, but like, they were interested in making movies. Or maybe they only wanted to make movies because they saw it as a way to make money. But at least they saw making movies as a way to make money, as opposed to what you're talking about, which is like, it could be movies, it could be diapers, it could be M&Ms. You know, like, it's just an entity. So I get that. I mean, someone with politics like mine, you risk getting into a thing where it's just like, there's no degree of nuance to any, you know what I mean? Where you're just totally dismissive of any ideas about change within a system that's existed for, you know, for however many centuries. And I think it's important to be able to hold both of those things in your mind and your heart, that you oppose capitalism, you don't believe in it, but at the same time, you don't act like there aren't degrees of difference inside of it that genuinely hurt people and harm people, or that makes the art that you love different. And it doesn't mean that you focus your energy on fighting for the return of a more conventional movie studio. It just means that you're able to see those things. It's a valuable skill to have, to be able to hold those things in your mind, to hold contradictions in your mind. In a way that I don't know. I don't know if we're less likely to do that now or not. But it certainly seems it's tempting to, you know what I mean? It's easier to see no degrees of variation within the thing that you oppose.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's good advice. Look, we're coming up on time. The last thing I want to say, and then I'll turn it over to you for the last word, is just on that mode of, you know, how we make these films. So my personal favorite filmmaker, Agnes Varda, in the 70s maybe? She makes Daguerreotypes, which is a movie I talk about on this podcast a lot.
I love it so much, yeah.
That movie is how far, you know, the cord can stretch.
Right.
To operate a movie camera. And then when she makes The Gleaners and I, she's just like, it's in my pocket. You know, it's in, I carry this movie around. And she makes a movie, The Gleaners and I, which is as good as any movie ever made. She's just a little old lady who's no longer getting funding like she used to for her movies. And it doesn't matter. She made one of the world bestriding masterpieces that I would put number one on the Sight and Sound list if I could.
And that's Gleaners?
Gleaners and I, yeah.
That's, although what
I
like, year is that?
It's like 99 or something.
So you're still, sis, it's interesting because I was just thinking about this the other day. You're still at that point making digital filmmaking at that point was still ending up on film.
Yes. Yes.
It was still being projected on film, which is maybe neither here nor there, but I just find it something that's valuable to point out, which is that like when Von Trier was making The Idiots or Breaking the Waves, or, you know, Harmony Korine was making Julian Donkey Boy, or Varda was making Gleaners and I. That's a different medium than what we're doing now with digital. Even if you're shooting it on your phone, the look of that stuff is completely different.
Yeah.
And you're really, my friend Robert Green and I back at North Carolina State were really interested in that look. I don't really have a point, but just to say that like, there is a, there was like this little tiny moment in movie making where digital filmmaking was really like digital / filmmaking.
Yeah.
And it was you know what it was? It was because like you were so hyper aware of like watching what you were looking at in a Brechtian way, where you were while you were watching a movie that was shot digitally and then transferred to film, it was really foregrounded in the viewing experience. Like, what is this thing that I'm looking at? Which is the way that like film feels now in a way. And luckily there's theaters here who will still show like an old beat up print of Rosemary's Baby or something like that, which I love. I love it so much. I love it when there's like frames missing, you know.
Yeah.
I love that experience of just feeling the film pass through the projector. It's just a completely different experience than the sort of the synthetic experience that we have now. And even like One Battle After Another, have you seen that yet?
I mean, I haven't.
Yeah. I mean, but you can really see like there's all this stuff about VistaVision and how it's shot. Like, it's shot at twice the size or something like that of yeah. like a of a normal. Which to me, when I hear that, I just think, oh, so it's like higher, quote unquote, higher quality. That's not something I'm terribly interested in. But you really can see it. I mean, I went to see it at the Vista, and you really can see the film passing through the projector in a really appealing way, and in a way that makes you think about the fact that you're watching a movie, which is important part of experiencing film, which is again a Brechtian thing of like reminding you that you're watching a play so that you think about what the play is doing. Your object is not to get lost in it. Your object is not to have an emotional experience. Your object is to have an analytical experience. And I think that like, I really think something as simple as like scratches on the film helps you do that. You were talking about Agnes Varda. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, you know, that she, someone like Varda, movies made with amateur, in other words, people have told me on this podcast that, you know, you can only make movies under capitalism because of the number of people involved and how much it costs to make a movie. And it's not true.
You mean people have said that movie making outside of capitalism is impossible?
Is impossible. Yeah.
Right.
Because you can't get $300 million except inside of capitalism.
But, right, which is just a limited way of thinking about what a movie is.
And that is
tied to just notions of quality and all the whole apparatus that's built around movie making that makes it so expensive is all just because, mostly just because of being tied to this idea of that the object of making a movie and watching a movie is to be tricked momentarily into thinking you're watching something. That when you see a building blow up, you're supposed to feel for a moment like a building really just blew up. Or when you see, which is like, that's just not, it's not how I watch movies at all. Which is what's so dispiriting about watching movies become, what's dispiriting about watching special effects become something that's done on a computer. I mean, I watched Total Recall last night for the first time since it came out, maybe. It's so great. And it's so, you're never not thinking about watching it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, Verhoeven's a special kind
of director. He's a Brechtian filmmaker, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. So maybe this is like a, but that was a 90, you know, that was a, you remember? I mean, that was a, that movie was a blockbuster. He made it between RoboCop and Basic Instinct. But like, I mean, I looked it up and my jaw dropped. I don't know why that was so like, I was just like, what a run, you know? And that completely, this is a great way to go out because it completely connects to what the book is about, which, and the characters talk about. Varda is one of the key figures for these for these guys, especially for one of the characters, Sandra, who's the sort of witchy character, is that if we get away from these, what they would call bourgeois notions of film viewing, we can make a new kind of movie. And I'll say that, like, one of the things that I think is important about this, not important to me about the subject matter of this book, is that their philosophy is very focused on how you watch movies. It's not about how you make movies. But what I realized is that those two things, I mean, duh, but like those two things are linked. But their approach is to say, what if we changed the way humanity watched movies? What would happen? And if we did it in the within the context of a awareness about capitalism and an ambition towards a Marxist revolution, what would that look like? How would we change the way that we try to get you to watch movies? And so to connect back to something we'd said at the beginning, and it's like, well, it would become less of a sacred space. It would become a place where it's just like, where we're there to be analytical. And it would become something where we weren't impressed by being fooled into thinking that what we were seeing on screen was real, that we derive our pleasure of film watching by thinking about the way it's made, by thinking about what I'm looking at, and that there becomes more and more pleasure in watching something where you can see and feel the way that it was made, the way that you can in Total Recall. Like, you can see what they're doing, and those ideas become more valuable. Like, there's a thing where, like, this drill goes through the wall, like a Martian wall of rock, and like, the rocks look like the color scheme looks like a steak. Like, it's like brown on the outside and kind of pink and then kind of brown. And it's very noticeable and very fake. And I was thinking, oh, like, the idea there, I think, is that like Martian rock is red, but there's all this debris on it on either side that's made it brown. And that's an idea that you get to kind of watch happen, even though it's like you're clearly looking at like foam core being tossed around, you know. It's so much more interesting and valuable and puts you in a mindset of analysis than the thing that we're talking about, which is that you need $300 million in order to make something that makes you forget that you're watching something that was made. So yeah, you're right. They're wrong. You can make movies. Because you should make things with limits. Limits are important. And that was another thing that was, like I said at the very beginning, like, I wanted to give myself a limit. Like, let me make something every day. Let me make a comic strip every day. That's a pretty sick, you know, like, and I have to do it. So like, I just have whatever idea I have in this 24-hour space, that's what I'll put on the page. Or in daguerreotypes, like, she'll film whatever she can get to by plugging the camera in. But it was like at her home, right?
Yeah.
However far the cord will go. I just feel like you should always do that. You know, like, that should be the idea. Or like, you should make a movie with the people who are around, you know, like, that's why, like, when people talk about like casting the perfect person for a role, I was cringe, you know? And it's like, no, it's exciting to watch someone not be able to do it. That's not the right phrasing. It's exciting to watch and to be able to sense both persons, the person being depicted and the person doing the depicting, and watching those things happen at once. And what's the cliche about a great performance, right? The great cliche is when they say, oh, if they didn't play, whatever, name it, they didn't play FDR, they were FDR. And it's always just like, that's the opposite of what I want to see.
All right. And that's,
did we do it? How'd we do?
Yeah. I think that's a radical way of watching movies.
There you go. Right.
All right. We did it. Yes. Yes. Okay. Nathan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
All right. We did our job, I hope.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.